Poor Things has captivated readers since its 1992 publication, earning Alistair Gray the Guardian Fiction Prize and Whitbread Novel Award. This postmodern gothic masterpiece has recently found new audiences through Yorgos Lanthimos's 2023 film adaptation starring Emma Stone, which won the Golden Lion at Venice Film Festival. The novel brilliantly subverts Victorian literature through its nested narratives and unreliable narrators, creating what Margaret Atwood called a mixture of fantasy, comedy, Scots dialect, and surrealist detail. What makes this book particularly fascinating is how it challenges readers to decide which version of its extraordinary story to believe, the fantastical tale of a woman with an infant's brain, or the rational explanation offered by a pioneering feminist doctor. Poor Things opens with an elaborate framing device. Gray presents himself as the editor of a found manuscript, a privately printed memoir by Archibald McCandless, titled Episodes from the Early Life of a Scottish Public Health Officer. The manuscript was supposedly discovered by local historian Michael Donnelly at Glasgow's People's Palace, along with a letter from Victoria McCandless, née Baxter, denouncing her husband's memoir as lies. Gray claims to have researched the historical records and found evidence supporting the memoir's authenticity, including documentation of the main character's existence, birth and death certificates, medical school records, and newspaper clippings from the period. This metafictional framework immediately establishes the novel's central tension between competing narratives. Are we reading a fantastical but true account of medical experimentation, or the delusional fantasies of a jealous husband? Gray's pseudo-scholarly introduction, complete with historical evidence, creates an illusion of authenticity while simultaneously undermining it. He includes detailed footnotes, cross-references, and scholarly citations that appear legitimate at first glance, but reveal subtle inconsistencies upon closer examination. The introduction even features reproductions of historical documents and photographs, their authenticity deliberately ambiguous. The framing device also serves to locate the story firmly within Victorian Glasgow, a setting Gray renders with vivid historical detail. The city becomes more than backdrop, it emerges as a character itself, with its medical schools, grand homes in Park Circus, public parks, and the River Clyde, all playing crucial roles in the unfolding drama. Gray meticulously recreates the period's medical practices, social conventions, and class divisions, weaving them into the fabric of the narrative. The Gothic architecture of the University of Glasgow, the industrial smokestacks along the Clyde, and the elegant Victorian townhouses of the West End create a richly textured world that bridges the historical and the fantastical. The multiple layers of narrative authenticity, from McCandless's memoir to Victoria's rebuttal letter to Gray's editorial commentary, create a complex dialogue about truth, perspective, and the nature of storytelling itself. Each narrator claims authority over the true version of events, yet their accounts conflict and contradict. This sophisticated narrative structure forces readers to become active participants in determining what to believe, mirroring the Victorian era's own struggles with scientific truth, religious faith, and social progress. Through this elaborate construction, Gray challenges conventional notions of historical truth and fictional invention, suggesting that perhaps the boundary between them is more permeable than we imagine. At the heart of Poor Things stands the enigmatic figure of Godwin Baxter, a character who embodies both the promise and peril of scientific advancement. Described as physically monstrous with an ogre-like body, but an infant-like face, Baxter is the son of Sir Colin Baxter, a renowned surgeon knighted by Queen Victoria. His appearance reflects his unnatural origins. He was reportedly born to a domestic servant late in his father's life, though hints throughout suggest he may himself be the product of his father's experiments. His massive frame, coupled with delicate features, creates an unsettling juxtaposition that both attracts and repels those who encounter him. Godwin's brilliance is matched only by his isolation, educated solely in mathematics, anatomy, and chemistry by a father who dismissed literature and religion as unprovable blethers, he grew up with little human contact beyond his father's dogs. This peculiar upbringing in his father's laboratory mansion created a genius with profound technical skill but limited emotional development. A man who can perform miraculous surgeries but struggles with basic human relationships. His social awkwardness manifests in stilted conversations and an inability to navigate the subtle nuances of Victorian society, leading him to retreat further into his scientific pursuits. When McCandless first visits Baxter's home, he discovers a cabinet of curiosities filled with telescopes, globes, stuffed birds, skeletons, and preserved specimens, physical manifestations of Baxter's attempt to understand the world through scientific classification rather than emotional connection. The house itself becomes an extension of Baxter's mind, with each room revealing layers of his obsession with understanding and controlling nature. Specimens float in jars of formaldehyde, anatomical charts cover the walls, and surgical instruments gleam menacingly in glass cases. Yet beneath this cold exterior lies a profound loneliness. Baxter confesses to feeling a woman-shaped emptiness inside him his entire life, revealing the human yearning that drives his scientific pursuits. Baxter's most astonishing creation, Bella, emerges from this intersection of scientific brilliance and emotional need. By transplanting an infant's brain into a dead woman's body, he creates not just a scientific marvel, but a companion who accepts him completely, taking him for granted as much as the floor under her. This achievement represents both the pinnacle of his scientific prowess and the fulfillment of his deepest emotional longing. Through Bella, Baxter attempts to create the perfect blend of innocence and maturity, a being who can bridge the gap between his scientific world and the emotional connections he desperately craves. His relationship with Bella becomes both paternal and possessive, reflecting his complex desires for both creation and connection. The character draws clear parallels to Mary Shelley's Victor Frankenstein, but where Frankenstein abandoned his creation, Baxter nurtures his, attempting to right the wrongs of his own isolated upbringing through his care of Bella. His laboratory becomes not just a place of scientific experimentation, but a space for emotional growth and healing, though the ethics of his experiments remain deeply questionable. Bella Baxter stands as one of literature's most remarkable female characters, a woman literally created by a man, but who ultimately transcends her origins to forge her own identity. According to Baxter's account, she began life as a drowned pregnant woman whose body he preserved while transplanting her unborn child's brain into her skull. This fantastic origin gives her the unique perspective of experiencing the world through adult eyes, but with a child's innocent curiosity. When first introduced, Bella speaks with childlike wonder and a carefully pronounced Northern English accent. She approaches everything, from piano playing to social interactions, with uninhibited enthusiasm. Her rapid intellectual development forms a central narrative thread as she progresses from childlike speech to sophisticated philosophical discourse in a matter of months. Bella's journey toward autonomy begins with her impulsive elopement with the lawyer, Duncan Letterburn. Though initially presented as a naive decision, this act represents her first assertion of independence from her creator. Their travels across Europe become an education in human nature, as Wedderburn's initial passion gives way to exhaustion and resentment. Through this relationship, Bella experiences both the pleasures and disappointments of conventional romance. The true transformation in Bella's character occurs in Alexandria, where she witnesses the brutal treatment of starving beggars by colonial authorities. This traumatic experience awakens her political consciousness and marks her evolution from pleasure-seeking somnambulist to a woman with moral purpose. Her subsequent encounters with Harry Astley's cynical worldview further sharpen her political thinking, leading her to declare, "I must be a socialist." By the time Bella returns to Glasgow, she has developed not only intellectually, but morally. She rejects the cynicism of Astley, the religious moralism of Dr. Hooker, and the libertine hedonism of Wedderburn in favor of a compassionate socialism focused on practical improvements to human welfare. Her decision to become a doctor specializing in women's health represents the culmination of this development, a choice that allows her to transform her own unusual origins into a force for social good. Poor Things brilliantly reimagines Gothic literary traditions for the Victorian medical context, weaving together themes of scientific ambition, bodily autonomy, and identity. Where Mary Shelley's Frankenstein created his monster from assembled body parts, Godwin Baxter performs a more subtle but equally transgressive act, transplanting an infant's brain into a woman's body. This medical intervention creates a being who exists at the intersection of multiple identities, child and adult, innocent and experienced, creation and creator. The novel explores how this unprecedented fusion challenges Victorian notions of personhood, consciousness, and the boundaries between life and death. The novel's treatment of the body is both grotesque and tender, reflecting Victorian medicine's simultaneous fascination with and fear of the human form. Baxter's own physique, with its ogre-like body, infant-like face, and strange cubical hand with babyish fingertips, marks him as physically other, a living embodiment of medical experimentation gone awry. Yet his surgical interventions are described with clinical precision that normalizes what should be horrifying. When demonstrating his skill to McCandless, Baxter shows him rabbits he's surgically altered, one black from nose to waist and white below, the other exactly reversed, with perfectly clean divisions as if cut by the surgeon's knife. These experiments serve as both proof of his extraordinary skill and a disturbing preview of his capabilities with human subjects. Bella's body becomes the central site of contested meaning in the novel, representing different things to each male character who encounters her. To Baxter, it represents his greatest achievement, a life saved from death through scientific intervention, and proof that death itself might be negotiable. To Wedderburn, it's an object of insatiable desire that ultimately exhausts him, representing both the height of sexual freedom and its limitations. To General Blessington, it's property to be reclaimed and controlled, embodying Victorian patriarchal attitudes toward women's bodies. To Dr. Prickett, it's a pathological entity requiring surgical correction to eliminate abnormal sexual desire, reflecting period anxieties about female sexuality. Each man projects his own meaning onto Bella's body, while she gradually claims ownership of it herself, learning to inhabit and understand her unique physical form. The climactic confrontation between Bella and General Blessington revolves around competing claims to her physical form, bringing the novel's themes of bodily autonomy and identity to a head. When Blessington insists she is his wife, Victoria, Baxter reveals his most compelling evidence: her body lacks the appendix scar Victoria should have. This moment transforms the Gothic horror of bodily transformation into a feminist triumph. Bella's new body literally frees her from her abusive past and the man who claimed ownership of her. The absence of the scar becomes a powerful symbol of her rebirth and independence, suggesting that physical transformation can lead to personal liberation. The novel thus uses the Gothic tradition's preoccupation with the body to explore thoroughly modern questions about identity, autonomy, and the relationship between physical form and consciousness. Through Bella's journey of self-discovery, it suggests that true personhood emerges not from the body we're given, but from how we choose to inhabit and understand it. Poor Things presents a searing critique of Victorian sexual politics through its multi-layered exploration of competing attitudes toward female sexuality. Dr. Prickett embodies the era's oppressive medical establishment, exemplifying how Victorian doctors pathologized normal female desire. When he insists that no normal healthy woman wants or expects to enjoy sexual contact except as a duty, he voices the period's dominant medical discourse that viewed female pleasure as inherently suspicious. His diagnosis of Victoria Blessington with erotomania for expressing sexual desire and his barbaric recommendation of clitorectomy as a cure for her hysterical desires reflects actual historical medical practices used to control women's bodies and desires. Against this repressive ideology, Bella emerges as a revolutionary figure whose uninhibited sexuality challenges Victorian social norms. She approaches physical pleasure with the same intellectual curiosity and unrestrained enthusiasm she brings to all experiences, treating it as a natural part of human existence rather than a moral failing. When McCandless expresses his Victorian shock at her casual attitude toward intimacy, she responds with refreshing candor about her sexual encounters all over the world, particularly describing her experiences with two petty officers from Nagasaki. Her frank discussions of desire and pleasure stand in stark contrast to the period's culture of silence and shame surrounding sexuality. The novel meticulously contrasts Bella's healthy approach to desire with the pathological sexuality of the men around her, revealing the hypocrisy of Victorian sexual standards. Duncan Wedderburn's psychological complex prevents him from loving respectable women of his own class, leading him to systematically pursue and destroy the lives of working-class women through pregnancy and abandonment. General Blessington's public image as an upright Victorian military hero masks his regular visits to Parisian brothels, where his reputation as Monsieur Spankybot reveals the dark underbelly of repressed desire. Even the seemingly rational Godman Baxter's creation of Bella carries undertones of sexual possession, suggesting that his scientific project is partly motivated by his own unfulfilled emotional and physical needs. Through these carefully constructed contrasting portrayals, Gray demonstrates how Victorian sexual repression generated far more psychological and social pathology than the natural desires it attempted to control. The novel traces Bella's sexual journey from innocent exploration with Wedderburn through various experiences to her eventual mature relationship with McCandless, presenting it as a triumphant rejection of Victorian sexual hypocrisy. Her evolution represents a movement toward authentic desire within the context of a loving relationship, offering a model of sexuality that integrates physical pleasure with emotional connection. This trajectory serves as both a critique of Victorian moral strictures and a vision of more honest and healthy approaches to human sexuality. As Bella travels beyond Glasgow, Poor Things expands its critique from Victorian sexual politics to British imperialism. Harry Astley emerges as the novel's most articulate defender of empire, describing himself as a Malthusianist who believes in the gospel according to Malthus, a philosophy that offers no comfort to the poor, the sick, the cruelly used, and those on the point of death. Through Astley's cynical lectures, Gray systematically dismantles the moral justifications for empire. Astley explains free trade as Britain's ability to buy as cheap as possible and sell as dear as possible anywhere with the help of our army and navy, comparing it to cutting up famine-stricken countries as readily as a carpenter cuts wood with a saw. He reveals how the Napoleonic Wars enriched Britain's industrial class while maintaining a permanent underclass of unemployed workers to keep wages low. The novel's most powerful indictment of colonialism comes through Bella's traumatic experience in Alexandria, where she witnesses starving beggars being whipped while wealthy tourists watch for entertainment. When she tries to help a blind little girl with a baby, she is forcibly restrained, while Astley and Dr. Hooker insist she could do no good. This moment transforms Bella's political consciousness, leading her to reject both Hooker's evangelical mission to purify the globe with fire and sword, and Astley's cynical acceptance of exploitation as inevitable. General Blessington personifies the violence of empire, celebrated by Victorian writers like Carlyle as a lean, skyward-pointing pine tree of a man, and commemorated in Tennyson's poetry, his military career built the empire through brutal force. The novel strips away this heroic facade to reveal a deeply disturbed man who abused his wife, abandoned his pregnant mistress, and ultimately takes his own life when his true nature is exposed. The novel's most radical element emerges in its final section, Victoria McCandless's explosive letter denouncing her husband's entire narrative as morbid Victorian fantasy. This feminist counter-narrative presents a completely different interpretation of the events described in McCandless's memoir, one that fundamentally challenges the patriarchal assumptions underlying the main text. According to Victoria, there was no brain transplant, no infant consciousness trapped in an adult body. Instead, she reveals herself as a young woman who fled her abusive husband, suffered a severe head injury that caused temporary amnesia, and was nursed back to health by the compassionate, if eccentric, Godwin Baxter. Her version transforms a gothic tale of male scientific achievement into a story of female survival and recovery. Victoria methodically dismantles her husband's account, identifying specific passages as plagiarized from various Gothic works, including Mary Shelley's Frankenstein and Robert Louis Stevenson's Jekyll and Hyde. She argues that his narrative stems from deep-seated psychological issues, his unresolved envy of Godwin's famous father and nurturing mother, his resentment of Victoria's privileged background and social accomplishments, and most devastatingly, his jealousy of the genuine love she and Godwin shared. His fictional account, she suggests, created what she terms an equality of deprivation, where all three main characters were denied proper childhoods, thereby leveling the social and emotional advantages she possessed. This competing narrative forces readers to fundamentally reconsider everything they've absorbed. The novel presents two equally plausible versions of reality. Was Bella truly an unprecedented surgical marvel with an infant's transplanted brain, or was she simply a traumatized woman recovering from domestic abuse and amnesia? Was Godwin Baxter a brilliant but morally compromised scientist who created life through unnatural means, or a humanitarian doctor who provided sanctuary to a vulnerable woman? The novel deliberately refuses to provide a definitive answer, instead challenging readers to examine their own biases and assumptions about gender, power, and truth-telling. Victoria's letter, dated August 1, 1914, the historic day World War I began, concludes with a passionate vision of the future through socialist revolution. Despite the ominous military buildup along the Clydeside, she maintains faith that the international socialist movement will prevent war through coordinated general strikes, ultimately transferring power from the owners to the makers. Her version transforms a gothic tale of male scientific achievement into a story of female survival and recovery. Victoria methodically dismantles her husband's account, identifying specific passages as plagiarized from various Gothic works, including Mary Shelley's Frankenstein and Robert Louis Stevenson's Jekyll and Hyde. She argues that his narrative stems from deep-seated psychological issues, his unresolved envy of Godwin's famous father and nurturing mother, his resentment of Victoria's privileged background and social accomplishments, and most devastatingly, his jealousy of the genuine love she and Godwin shared. His fictional account, she suggests, created what she terms an equality of deprivation, where all three main characters were denied proper childhoods, thereby leveling the social and emotional advantages she possessed. This competing narrative forces readers to fundamentally reconsider everything they've absorbed. The novel presents two equally plausible versions of reality. Was Bella truly an unprecedented surgical marvel with an infant's transplanted brain? Or was she simply a traumatized woman recovering from domestic abuse and amnesia? Was Godwin Baxter a brilliant but morally compromised scientist who created life through unnatural means, or a humanitarian doctor who provided sanctuary to a vulnerable woman? The novel deliberately refuses to provide a definitive answer, instead challenging readers to examine their own biases and assumptions about gender, power, and truth-telling. Poor Things ultimately becomes a profound meditation on narrative reliability and historical truth, weaving together multiple layers of unreliability that challenge readers' assumptions about authenticity and factual accuracy. Every voice in the novel stakes its claim to truth while systematically undermining others, creating a complex web of competing narratives. Archibald McCandless presents his fantastic tale with earnest conviction, yet simultaneously undermines his own credibility by acknowledging his use of melodramatic language borrowed from penny dreadfuls and sensation novels. Gray, positioning himself as a meticulous scholarly editor, deliberately sabotages his own authority by including contradictory historical evidence and anachronistic details that alert careful readers to the constructed nature of his academic persona. The novel's intricate structure mirrors Victorian literary conventions while subverting them. Its nested narratives include personal letters, medical records, newspaper clippings, and competing biographical accounts, each claiming supremacy while subtly revealing its own limitations. The pseudo-scholarly apparatus, including extensive footnotes, cross-references, and carefully crafted illustrations, simultaneously mimics and mocks the 19th-century drive toward comprehensive documentation. This layered approach creates a literary palimpsest where each new narrative partially erases and rewrites what came before. The Victorian setting proves crucial to this exploration of truth and fiction. The era's competing intellectual and cultural currents provide rich material for Gray's postmodern examination. The period witnessed fierce debates between materialist and spiritualist worldviews, exemplified by figures like Darwin and the Society for Psychical Research. Medical advances coincided with renewed interest in mesmerism and the occult. The novel captures these contradictions through characters like Godwin Baxter, who embodies both scientific rationalism and gothic experimentation. Victoria's counter-narrative introduces yet another layer of complexity. Her seemingly rational explanation of events appears designed to satisfy modern sensibilities, yet raises its own questions about motivation and reliability. Her dismissal of McCandless's account as mere fiction paradoxically draws attention to the constructed nature of her own narrative. This tension between fantastic and rational explanations mirrors Victorian debates about the relationship between scientific observation and supernatural explanation. The novel's deliberate ambiguity extends beyond its plot to encompass deeper questions about historical knowledge and narrative authority. By refusing to privilege any single account, Gray suggests that historical truth is inherently multiple, contradictory, and shaped by cultural contexts. The competing narratives force readers to confront their own assumptions about reliability and evidence. This radical uncertainty transforms Poor Things from a mere pastiche of Victorian literature into a sophisticated exploration of how societies construct and validate knowledge through narrative frameworks. Through this complex interplay of voices and perspectives, the novel ultimately suggests that truth itself is neither singular nor stable, but rather a product of ongoing negotiation between competing narratives and interpretive frameworks. This postmodern sensibility, when applied to Victorian materials, reveals surprising continuities between 19th century and contemporary concerns about authenticity, authority, and the nature of truth itself.